Okay. All right. Well, all right. My name is Peter Abamonte. I'm not a theorist, though I do as much theory as needed to make to at least talk to theorists, and at that point I usually stop. It's a great pleasure to get my own captive audience of theorists. It's something that has rarely happens in my life, so it's a wonderful thing. Today I'm going to talk about a new experimental result that is only about 6 weeks old. And in the beginning, I did not believe it. And the last six, well, I guess it's 8 weeks now, we've been going through control experiments and are now sort of at the 99% point where we find that we have no choice but to go public with what we see. What we see is charge order in this, in lanthanum strontium cuprate, which is something people have been looking for a long time. The work was done mainly by my former student, Andrivo Rushdie, who's now in Hamburg as a postdoc and about to start his own faculty position in Singapore, and my postdoc, Servance Modici, and two graduate students in my group. The synthesis of samples was done by Masaki Fujita and his student at Tohoku University in Sendai, and I had very helpful and heated discussions in some cases with Eduardo Fradkin and Steve Kivelson and John Tronquata, who is great quality control, and Young Lee and Oleg Sushkov, who I've learned about spiral phases from quite a bit, mainly by reading the papers, but we emailed a little bit too. Okay, so this conference is about Mott physics, right? So here is a Mott insulator, and a Mott insulator is a thing that is insulating at half filling, and sometimes there's a superfluous order parameter floating around like anti-ferromagnetism. And if you pull fermions out, so to make holes, then they in principle want to move around. And this system is quantum frustrated in the sense that if the holes try to move to left and right, they leave along a trail of unpaired spins or of unhappy bonds, and that makes them unhappy. So in these systems, as you probably know, there's innate conflict between the desire of the carriers to move around and the desire of the native carriers, the native fermions, to keep nail order. And so there have been lots of speculation and a few computer simulations that show that the system has a tendency to phase segregate into charged domain lines, and which separate regions of nail order, and these things are called stripes. And the distinction between these and a spiral, I think, sometimes is maybe a matter of semantics. But anyway, the key trait of these predicted phases, which I've finally come to realize were not predicted first by any one person, but independently by at least four different groups, is that the wave vector, the wavelength of the charge, if these things happen to order, is a factor of two shorter than the wavelength of the magnetism. So in other words, these charge domain lines that arise through phase separation separate regions of anti-ferromagnetism, and there's a pi phase shift between this magnetism and that magnetism, and that way the system can resolve its frustration. So it's sort of a compromise where the carriers can delocalize in this way all they want. They can't delocalize this way, but at least you get to have, but then you get to have some magnetism hanging around.
Peter?
Yeah.
Can you expand upon this remark that it's spirals are just the same thing? I don't really understand that.
I've got a slide on that coming up. Actually, I'm going to say they are different, but they may not be, because spirals may also have superfluous charge order present. And then when you have charge and magnetic order present simultaneously, how do you know if it's a stripe or a spiral? That's a question that we.
That's the question of harmonics. If it's sinusoidal, then it's.
Well, I'm told that. That's what I used to say, but I'm told by the stripe guys on the previous slide that a stripe can be sinusoidal. There's no reason. The important definition of a stripe is that they're strong coupling. Yeah. Well, okay. So I, as an experimentalist, I stay out of semantic debates. We're just going to say what we see. Okay, so everywhere, by the way, in my talk, I will have the word stripes in quotation marks, meaning, and my definition of this is something where you have simultaneous charge and spin order present with a factor of two wave vector difference. Okay, so there are many, if you go through the literature, you can find literally thousands of papers that report evidence for stripes. based on resistive anisotropies and anisotropies in the optical conductivity and wipeout effects and NMR and so on. But the only thing that really, in my opinion, is a almost smoking gun measurement of stripes is this paper by John Tronquata in the mid-90s and the subsequent literature on the subject, where they looked at this 2-1-4-phase cuprate at 1/8 filling, 1/8 doping, sorry, not filling, it's 1/8 strontium, and you put in neodymium, and what that does is it drives the system into a phase called a low-temperature tetragonal phase at low temperature, and that is a particular pattern of the tilting of the octahedra. And when you do that, superconductivity vanishes, essentially. TC goes almost to zero. And what you find if you do neutron scattering is a superlattice. And the superlattice has both charge and spin order. So now, just for you guys are theorists, and theorists think in units of pi. So I'm going to, in my talk, try to translate between pi and Miller indices. I think one of the reasons ARPES has been so much more successful than neutron scattering is because they got wise and plotted 0 to pi instead of 0 to a half or 0 to 1. So, but nonetheless, there's this huge literature. Well, all right, we'll have that conversation tonight over a beer or something. Anyway, these are the Brillouin zones. So the normal Brillouin zone you normally think of is this thing right here. Okay, that's the gamma point. Pi is here. In this phase, you get incommensurate anti-ferromagnetism around the pi point, which is to say that there's nail order, but it's slowly modulated. And then around the gamma point, you have some charge peaks, and there's an incommensuration parameter that describes the wave vector of the order. And the key observation is the ratio of the magnetic to the charge incommensuration parameter is a half. And that one half is the same as this one half. At least as is claimed here, right? So the wavelength of the magnetic order is 2 times that of the charge
Shouldn't
order.
It always be the case because of the simply less invariant.
That's my next thing. Okay, so this is the dogma, okay? And then empirically, it's found that delta M is always equal to X, which means if you just count charges, the stripes, if that's what they are, have to be half filled. And even if they're not stripes, they have to be half filled to conserve charge. And if it's a Wigner crystal kind of order. Anyway, so that's an empirical observation that's always true. Okay, so just in anticipation of Chomsky, I always like to show this plot, which was published not by John Tronquata, but by John Hill, same department actually, same year. This is the spin density wave in chromium. This paper, by the way, has about 1,500 citations. This one has about 16, last I checked. So anyway, chromium, which does not have stripes, has also spin and charge reflections, and the charge. So it also has slowly modulated anti-ferromagnetism, and that gives you magnetic peaks around here, and then there are also charge peaks. And again, you see if you plot the ratio, again this factor of one half, So, in fact, as far as the diffraction peaks goes, the phase in the high TCs looks just like basically chromium. And if you think about it, it can't be any other way, because if you try to construct a free energy invariant out of charge and spin, charge is a scalar and spin is a vector. So if you try to make a scalar quantity, it has to enter as powers of rho s squared or something like that. And so it really can't be any other way. So something that sometimes is not really fully appreciated is that the real signature of stripe order is the temperature dependence. And that is that if you plot the intensity of the square of the intensity of the spin order parameter against the intensity of the charge order parameter, you get a line, because they are coupled together in the free energy like rho s squared. In the stripe phase, they do not do that. So if you square the magnetic part, it does not track the charge part. The charge part sets in at a higher temperature, and they don't follow this simple relationship. And that means that this does not enter in some linear order. It enters in some higher power. And in other words, this, the claim is a non-perturbative problem. And therefore, that's the distinction between stripes and spin density waves. And I'm just giving you other people's arguments at this point.
But so then why is one help?
What?
Then why is one help?
You still have to put in things that look like this. I mean, rho s to the.
But you just said that in IDCs, the invariant is different. In Cooper's invariant is different.
And it's still, you still have to get a scalar when you're done. I don't know. I don't have an explanation. I'm just trying to reiterate the story as best I can. It's this or some power of this that enters.
But then you should expect different ratio
of this. I think if the relative power is still, I mean, if you have rho s to the fourth, then of course it doesn't work. But, okay, that's a wonderful subject for discussion. Okay, so there are basically two materials in which, if you define stripes as coexisting charge and spin order, there's basically two materials in which they have been seen. There's this material and there's lanthanum barium copper oxide, which also has an LTT transition at low temperature and also looks the same as far as the Bragg peaks go. Other than that, they have not been seen in anything. Okay? Now, in particular, what? Sorry, yeah, there's also the nickelate. Yeah. I mean, in the context.
ITC materials.
ITC materials, yeah. I mean, okay, so the manganites also have coexisting spin and charge order and so on. But what, okay, so what is this stripe? So as far as high TC goes, they've only been seen in this. Okay, so one notoriously absent material is just plain old LSCO. This material shows spin correlations throughout its phase diagram. And so starting from x equals 0 at half filling going up, you have spin correlations that are incommensurate through the whole phase diagram. They're static or quasi-static up into the insulator to superconductor transition. And then after that, they become dynamic, but they're still incommensurate. And LSCO has at low temperature, it goes into a low temperature orthorhombic phase, which basically looks like this, the octahedra tilt around the 100 direction. I'm sorry, around the 110 direction in tetragonal units. So the repeating unit looks like this. So we tend to use the orthorhombic lattice parameter. Anyway, I'll get to that in a minute. So these things at very light doping have diagonal stripes. So again, here are Brillouin zones as drawn by neutron scatterers. The familiar Brillouin zone to you probably is the dotted line with the pi point sitting here and the pi zero point sitting there. And since it's slightly orthorhombic, there are actually two domains because A and B are a little bit different. So that means the pi point is split. And one of the important observations from LSCO is that the order is unidirectional. And that means that you see four satellites around the pi point. But you can show, because they're twin domains, that two of them are associated with one of the points. And the other two are associated with the other. And because of the twinning, you would actually expect eight peaks, but you only see four, and that shows that within each domain, the spin modulation is unidirectional. So that was cited as positive for the stripe model, which ought to be unidirectionally ordered. But the big problem with this stuff is that it does not show any evidence at all for charge order. People have looked many, many times and have not been able to find any sibling charge reflections around the origin.
That's magnetic, eh?
What?
That's magnetic up here.
This is magnetic up here, yeah. You would expect charge peaks down here if there was coexisting charge and spin order, but they're not observed.
What's X for this picture here?
In this one, it's 0.04, but this is a this is sort of generally true for anything
that's
to the left of this for x of below 0.055.
So that's before they rotate.
Yes, that's right. I didn't even say that they rotate. But yeah, as you increase, so this is before they rotate, they're diagonal. And then when x reaches 0.55, there's a transition to which they become horizontal. They go in this direction here. So they rotate 45 degrees. Nonetheless, delta is always equal to x. They always still fall on a line. In the neutron world, this thing is called a Yamada plot. So they're always linear, and that, no matter how you measure it. Okay. All right. But anyway, the point is there's no charge order observed. So that's led to a lot of speculation. Maybe it's not even speculation that this thing is not from stripes at all. There is, in fact, from a spiral spin density wave. And this is something I've just been learning about the last few months. But basically, You can show that if you just take a simple classical nonlinear sigma model for the spins with an n as an order parameter for the anti-ferromagnetism, and you put in some point impurities. So, and the people who work on this argue that one hole acts as an impurity which is equivalent to one ferromagnetic bond in the anti-ferromagnetic background, and that creates a defect. And if you have enough of these defects, they will cause the ground state to become a spiral spin density wave state, which looks like this. And it has a well-defined wave vector, which is determined by the spin stiffness, though I'm not sure that works in this Hamiltonian. But anyway, and the density of carriers, and you can see that there's a derivative of n here, and that is sort of what favors a rotationally modulated.
Why do you say that this spiral is connected with defects and with spiral bonds?
Defects meaning holes. If you don't have any holes, you just get a nail stick.
Your picture is that simply you have kind of a firm surface netting or whatever, and when you dope it, you change the wave vector, and that actually determines the periodicity of your spin density wave, which is spiral.
Yeah.
And that's it. No defect, no localization, no such stuff.
Yeah.
If you have such stuff, then I would expect not a spiral, but rather something like, okay,
that is
in glass-like disorder.
That's also what I would expect.
Not a spiral. So
but nonetheless, you take this picture and you Fourier transform it, and you get peaks.
You still have correlation length, even in such a mess.
And the length scale is just determined by the average spacing between defects, where a defect is a doped hole.
Is it diffuse there?
It's diffuse, but there's a well-defined length scale. And this is, in the black, is neutron scattering at x equals 0.04, and that's the points, and the lines are just the Fourier transform of this plot. And the amazing thing is you change the defect density, these things shift because it changes the length scale that's present, and they track very well the Yamada plot. And I was...
So this is a model calculation, I guess, these last two papers?
It's just a solution to this. Well, this is actually from a different paper than this, but they use the classical nonlinear sigma model.
Actually, Schremer didn't use that. He just did the TJ model.
I believe that's true, yeah. So this is it's these three papers that use the classical.
So you just have a random...
It's just a random field, yeah. A random field of point ferromagnetic bonds.
And structure factor shifts from pi pi.
That's what they say, this calculation was done by Oleg Sushkov, I saw him give a talk, and he showed this picture, and then he showed this picture, and I said, how does that picture give you this picture? I raised my hand, and he said, you Fourier transform this, and you get this. This is literally the Fourier transform of that.
Well, is there a simple way to understand the Yamada relation from here?
Only the sense that if you make these things, the defects farther apart, it makes the wavelength longer of this pinned spiral phase. I defer further questions to Oleg.
How did we get this pattern on the left? This is a theoretical calculation.
This, these are randomly placed impurities.
So, and these impurities are random ferromagnetic bonds.
Yeah, like that.
Classical.
It's purely classical calculation.
Random ferromagnetic bond and anti-ferromagnetic spiral.
Very strange, but they have several. They even claim that they get the rotation by 45 degrees at 0.055. So that doesn't seem to be anything.
Of course. Yeah, right.
You get some. Yeah, it's obviously broad, right?
Well, what you're going to happen, right? Is you're going to have at large distance, you're going to lose the nail order. And so, but you have defects, and so there's going to be a typical distance between the defects, and so they won't match, right? They will have the spin will have to precess
right.
To
which would be some point G1 and G2, next near neighbor and near neighbor.
No. That's simply the field close to this wrong bond, then the distortion decays because it's golden. There are golden bonds that decay very slowly.
Right.
Then they don't match actually the distortion from different defects. They have to adjust somehow, and maybe that's they have to twist somehow. That's possible, but not trivial. Not.
Well, actually, what they do, you can see in this picture. It shows exactly what they do. So somehow this gives you this. Anyway, this is sort of motivational. The point here is that so this does not imply any charge order at all. It's something that just happens in the spin channel. And this is proposed as an alternative explanation to what's happening in LSCO. And you don't need stripes to get it. It just comes from the defects, according to this.
Wait a minute. Why not? You always have these couplings which you wrote yourself. Rho times S squared.
Yeah.
And then.
Then you should. Charge is not a priori required to get this ground state. It may occur as some incidental thing.
But later distortion should follow.
So that's my point. All right, so let's talk about that. Neutrons do not measure charge, right? A neutron is neutral. All it measures is lattice distortions, which could be small for a variety of reasons relating to the stiffness of the material and all kinds of things. And also, this scattering is very diffuse, so there's a good chance that it simply could have been missed. All right, so there ought to be a better way to go about looking for charge order in this system than this. So what we did was do resonant X-ray scattering, which there are several people here interested in. The way it works, this is a very toned down slide. So if you don't like it, we can talk about the multiplets separately. But anyway, what I tell people who don't care about scattering is that the way this works is you take a photon, you fire it at the sample. You promote an electron from a core state up into the unoccupied part of the valence band. It elastically de-excites down and radiates another photon. And what you do is you detect the angular distribution of this, and also study the density of states by varying this energy. So basically, it's a bit like regular X-ray scattering, except in the case of normal X-ray scattering, you get a Bragg peak whenever there's some modulation in the charge density. In this technique, you get a Bragg peak if there is a modulation in the unoccupied density of states. So it measures directly the valence band and not just the structure. So that's sort of the idea. And actually, if you neglect excitonic effects, which you can almost never do, but there are some cases where you can, the cross-section you can actually map onto G of K and omega, which is the same quantity with some prefactors that are polarization dependent, mod squared, where G of K and omega is just the quantity measured in STM. Right, everybody's probably seen these STS studies now. So they measure DIDV in a big field of view, and they Fourier transform into momentum space. We basically measure this directly, but only a positive bias by their definition. So the good thing about this is it's bulk sensitive. We can study anything. We can study things that don't cleave, heterostructures, buried interfaces, and so on, which is a lot of what we do. We can scan the temperature, which they cannot do with STM. And the wavelength is suitable for nanoscale order, but the disadvantage is we have an intrinsic 150 millivolt radiative lifetime broadening depending upon which edge we use that washes out fine structure, but nonetheless, it's still useful.
This so is numbers for LH? That's
the oxygen K edge, where the excitonic effects are not that important. We've used this to study the so-called stripes in LBCO because, as you know, they only look at the lattice distortions and it looks just like chromium. And we actually showed that system, they're actually charged. The valence modulation is of order one electron. The idea was to apply that technique to LSCO to look for valence band order because there could be valence band order, but you just don't see it with neutrons because the lattice isn't involved for some reason or another. And that was trick number one. Trick number two was to dope with zinc. What does zinc do? If you take zinc and you put it in LSCO, it substitutes for a copper. So it goes right into the copper oxide plane. And zinc goes in as 2+. It's actually a little different than that, but roughly 2+. And zinc 2+ is 3d10. So it's non-magnetic. It just enters as a random field. A non-magnetic random potential in the copper oxide plane. And one of the old, I don't know if anybody follows zinc, but follows impurities, but one of the old mysteries is that zinc actually suppresses TC. So this is the phase diagram for LSCO. That's the superconducting dome. This is X and that's TC. So this is LSCO. You can see a little dimple there at an eighth. If you put in zinc, it suppresses it way down to here, and it magnifies this 1/8 anomaly. And interestingly, it suppresses TC even more than nickel, which is very surprising because nickel is actually a magnetic impurity, and you think it would be even worse for superconductivity than nickel, than zinc. But it turns out it's not as bad. So what does zinc do? Many people are not aware of this plot. So this actually, this is neutron scattering through the magnetic incommensuration points in the elastic channel, that is with zero energy transfer. This is optimally doped LSCO without zinc, and you see you just get some diffuse scattering. Below TC, there's actually a spin gap. But if you put in zinc, you get nice, sharp, coherent Bragg reflections that appear. So if you go a little bit to the inelastic channel, you find that they actually look exactly the same. So it only looks a little different right in the elastic part. So in other words, zinc, it's non-magnetic, but it pins the magnetic fluctuations somehow, and it gives you coherent scattering. All right, coherent elastic, what you might call quote Bragg scattering, meaning it's well within the energy window of the bandpass of the neutrons. Okay, so the hope was, first we looked at LSCO without zinc, and that didn't work. So we looked at it with zinc to try to see if we could pin the stripes, or whatever they are, using this method. Okay. So just some experimental details. This is the material that we looked at. We looked at 5% doped. So it's below the insulator to superconductor transition. So it's in the insulating phase. TC is 0K. It has 5% zinc substituted for copper. So that's actually quite a bit in terms of distances between zincs. The samples were 95%. Single domain, they were D-twinned, so it's basically one domain, or there are a little bit of twins in there. And here are the Brillouin zones, and I just want to do a little bit of translation again. In scattering, we use this notation, we use Miller indices to denote momenta. So Q in inverse angstroms is this, and this is very important because in scattering we have a Z component of the momentum. Theorists frequently forget about the momentum perpendicular to the copper oxide plane, but that's very important because it determines, in many cases, how the order stacks from one layer to the next. In ARPES, you don't get that because it's surface sensitive, but in principle, it's there. So in momentum transfer Q, we will write in a shorthand of three letters, H, K, and L, and these are normally, for integer values, are just Bragg reflections, and let me just say, this is the gamma point, this is the pi-pi point, that's where antiferromagnetism would be in the insulator, that we call 0,1L, okay? And so that's the pi-pi point. The pi-zero point is a half, okay, that's here, and L is the Z component of the momentum. You could call it K sub Z if you want, but that's what we'll call it L. And up here is where diagonal unidirectional correlations have been observed with neutrons across the phase diagram. And they sit at, if you write them out the way they write them in the neutron paper, 0, 1 plus or minus delta ML, where L is the Z component. And the place where you expect charge correlations to be present is here. Okay, so these things should be satellites around the antiferromagnetic point. The charge peaks should be satellites around the gamma point. Okay, so that's where you want to look. So we got zinc dope samples, we did resonance scattering, and we tuned through there, and boom, there it is, a nice big peak. 15,000 counts a second. Almost have to attenuate the beam to measure them. So this is this again is the zones. This is at L equals 2, and I'll explain the significance of that in terms of stacking in a minute, but scan A is scanned through here, and there you see a nice peak. It sits in the same samples measured with neutrons, delta M, the magnetic incommensuration parameter is 0.0489. Not all those digits are significant, but that's what they state it to be. The charge position that we measure is 0.084, and the ratio is 0.57. So it's close to a half, but not exactly. If you map this thing in two dimensions, So that is just an area scan around here, a section through it in two dimensions. You get its correlation length from the width, and they are ludicrously big, totally unphysically large. And it's 300 lattice parameters in the A direction, 370 in the B direction, and 183 lattice parameters along the C axis. So I looked at this and I said, this is an artifact. Somebody is shining a laser pointer in the side, the vacuum viewports of the thing, and the beam is going in the detector, and it looks like a Bragg peak, but it's not. And that was completely confirmed when I looked at this data. So this is the temperature dependence of the neutron in commensurate scattering with the same zinc of 5%. You can see at 5K you have nice scattering here. This is 400 counts in 10 minutes or something like that. And then around 20K it decays down to the background level. Our peak is still visible up at room temperature, 300K. And this convinced me that it had to be wrong. Couldn't possibly be real. But nonetheless, what would do that? What would even be aware of energy scales of KT? Anyway, an interesting thing we saw is that the wave vector of the peak actually shifts with temperature. And that looks a whole lot like the spin density wave in chromium, by the way. It shifts with temperature. And that is a lattice pinning effect. That's because the wave vector determined by the nesting vector doesn't match the lattice. And so at low energy, to minimize the total energy, it acquires phase slips and changes the wave vector a little bit. That's all. It moves to a little bit higher in Q, but not to any particularly magic number, nor does it in chromium. It just shifts. Yeah, this.
So that thing moves where?
It moves out a little bit, but just a 1%. It's so sharp you can. It may be the. What?
What about magnetic peak extension?
It's 20K. It's gone at 20.
Can you also see the magnetic peak?
No.
But
that's been done with neutrons many times. This is the intent. This is wave vector here. This is K. This is K, which is this K. This is K here, which is the same as this K, which is the same as this. Okay? And also they're diagonal, right? These are diagonal and these are diagonal. So it's also going the right direction. And it has two times the wave vector. So let me just put my exclamation point here. What?
The intensity is much weaker.
Weaker than what? Yeah, so obviously it knows about KT. So it looks a bit like the temperature dependence of blue bronze or some old style charge density wave.
Now, this unidirectionality which you mentioned, you have orthorhombic samples, sorry, you have
orthorhombic.
VR in equilibrium.
Yeah.
So is it simply possible to say that it's always along, say, A or B?
It's always along B, which means the modulate, the stripes, if that's what they are, they run along A. And I'll show you the twin domains in just a second. Okay, so that's really weird. So at that point, we stopped and we said, as experimentalists, right, we have to think about what are the possible, likely, aberrant sources of that could cause this. And there are mainly three. The first one is the possibility that it's just specular reflection from the surface of the sample. Another possibility is it's just the 002 Bragg reflection due to a grain that's been misoriented slightly, though that wouldn't be temperature dependent. Another is that adding zinc, and this is stretching a little bit, creates some kind of misfit modulation due to strain like that which is seen in BISCO, which gives you the ghost bands in ARPES, for example. So what I'm not going to do, what we're going to do is we're going to look at all of the data and then at the end discount these possibilities. Okay?
You think ordering?
Cation ordering of the zincs? That would be a fourth one, and I'll discount that for you too. Okay, so the main thing, the main slide is this one. You have to look at the energy dependence, and this we have a lot of experience with in the high TCs. There's a whole theory for how to account for the energy dependence, and it is in terms of dividing up a thing called the atomic scattering factor into two pieces, a raw piece, which is characteristic of just every copper atom, and a doping-dependent piece. And this describes how the spectral weight, how much the spectral weight varies when you add a single hole to the to a copper. Actually, it goes on the oxygens around it. That's a whole seminar. But anyway, these two things you can measure from X-ray absorption. They're complex. They have real and imaginary parts. You have to get both from Kramer's Kroning. And the important thing is that F, that charge scattering that is from the valence, tracks this quantity F sub D, whereas strain scattering tracks this quantity F sub R and a little bit of F sub D too. Okay, so they do not have the same energy dependence, and you can separate them, and we've got a paper coming out on spin chains that that where all this works very nicely. And this is what it looks like for copper. So you can see FD has a peak at a slightly higher. This is the black one is the imaginary part of FD. That would be the charge scattering. The green one is the imaginary part of FR. That would be the strain, the lattice scattering. And if you measure the energy dependence of this magic peak, it resonates at the upper edge of the copper L2. Okay, so this black curve is X-ray absorption measurements at the copper L2 edge. That's a 2p 1/2 to 3d transition of the atom, and you can see that the where a regular Bragg peak, the 002, the energy dependence looks like this. It resonates at the lower shoulder, tracking this quantity FR, which is pretty big. If you plot the energy dependence of this superlattice reflection, it tracks, it resonates in the right place at the upper shoulder. And that's actually it. The reason that it resonates up there is an excitonic effect related to screening of the hole by the corp potential. And I'd be happy to talk more about that. But anyway, we have several papers showing that valence modulations resonate up here, whereas strain modulations resonate down here, and lots of data that's not published also showing that. So it has all the signature of valence band charge order with a rather small strain wave. Yeah.
So the original, the neutron result you showed with without the zinc, which had this double peak, which is magically explained by the small.
Yeah.
What was the baseline temperature the experiment went to?
20. It goes to 20K.
Okay, and so the X-ray went to what temperature?
300.
Like went down to what temperature?
Oh, well, you didn't even go down below 40K because
so now that's intensity. 5% strontium, right?
5% zinc. 5% strontium also, yeah.
So what is the temperature when you measure the magnetization where you see irreversibility for that sample?
That has not been done.
I think it didn't get done by postdoc or grad students of Bergeron way back.
Not with 5% zinc.
Well, 4%. Oh.
4 and 5 are completely different. Actually, 3% zinc. 5%. If you do 3% zinc, none of this happens. You have to get up to 5.
So is it possible you didn't go to low enough temperature in the X-rays to see it if it was fluctuating, or you just had a broadening at the gamma point?
So you mean in this particular sample?
No, without the zinc. Like the baseline temperature was too high.
They went to, I guess that's always possible. They went to 4K.
40, you said.
I went to 40. You're talking about what happens in neutrons if you have no zinc, right?
I'm talking about what happens in X-rays if you have no zinc.
In X-rays, we actually have never gone below 20 Kelvin with X-rays.
Maybe it's there.
Maybe. Yeah.
The zinc just pushes it up and stabilizes
yeah.
it.
So that's right. Could be. I mean, it's always even if we looked at 5 Kelvin, you could say it could be at 1 Kelvin, and you can always keep going, right? The problem is each factor of 2 in temperature is a factor of 10 in money to upgrade the cryostat and instrumentation and so on. So, yeah, what you're saying is in principle correct.
It could just expect 3%.
Expect what?
To see
this. We haven't looked at 3%. We've looked at 0 and we've looked at 5. Neutron people have done 3% many times and never reported any elastic incommensurate scattering. In fact, there's a paper where they did 3% and they did 5%. This was from our collaborators in Sendai who showed that there's just magnetic order. And actually, one of those samples was exactly this sample, so they actually didn't look. Because they went back and looked at this sample and it's actually there with neutrons. This is a very...
That's zinc 5% and strontium?
Yeah.
How much strontium?
5%. Yeah, this is the at the very end. This is we sent the sample back and they did neutrons on it and you see it. It's in the same place. So they just missed it. I want to get through all the slides before we talk about all this. Anyway, the energy dependence is consistent with valence band order. Okay, so the next issue is that of stacking. In LBCO, they stack in a very convoluted way. In one layer, it looks like they're unidirectional along one direction, and the next layer unidirectional along the other direction, and then in the third layer unidirectional back this way again, except offset by two lattice parameters from this one because of long-range Coulomb repulsion, which is because they're insulating and they're bad or semiconductors and they don't screen very well. So we wanted to know how these stack, and to do that you have to measure several different L values. So we looked at all these points, all eight of these points, and so we looked. We see the peak along this direction. We also see the sibling along that direction. If you turn 90 degrees and scan this way, you actually can see the peak. There it is. It's no longer 15 kilohertz. It's a few hundred hertz, and that's roughly consistent with the 95% degree of sample twinning. So you can see little reflections due to the twin domains. And then if you go to L equals 1, that's one layer down in the Brillouin zones along the C-axis, and you see nothing. So we scanned all four points and saw no Bragg peaks. They're symmetry forbidden. So it turns out the only, or anyway, the simplest modulation you can write down that has that set of extinction rules is this one. That's where I drew them as lines, but they're broad because I didn't want to make them look like stripes, but I didn't know how to. I didn't want to make them not look like stripes either. And they stack on top of one another. So these are the. So in LSCO, there are two independent copper oxide planes that are offset by half a lattice parameter. There's a glide plane symmetry between the two layers. And so and the point here is that these structures, these electronic structures, are stacked on top of one another in this fashion. They are not staggered. And that we did a whole set of experiments just to determine that. And it's because I didn't believe it, because I thought they would have to be staggered by just Coulomb, because that's what they do in LBCO. But we don't see these peaks. And
more or less to be expected, maybe if you use a train coming.
I love having Daniel in the
then
audience.
You have to have some distortion.
So here are the distortions. Yes, I love having you in the audience because I don't have to introduce anything. Anyway, if you look off resonance,
how much correlation length around the sea?
It's 183 lattice parameters. It's basically it's three-dimensionally long-range ordered thing like chromium, or like blue bronze. Looks like an old-fashioned charge density wave, except the lattice distortion is very small. So how small is it? From a few peaks, we actually can't tell which atoms move or which way. So we have to look at some models. There is an important thing here, which is that if we go off to very far off of any resonant and just do plain old scattering, we still see the super lattice. It's not 15 kilohertz anymore, it's 25 hertz. It's very tiny, very weak, but it's there. And from the ratio, if we assume a certain filling level for the charge, if we just assume charge conservation for the valence modulation, we can put some numbers on potential scenarios for lattice distortions. And there are three plausible ones. One is involves distortions of the lanthanum atoms. And here's right out of my notebook what it might look like. So this is a 12 unit cell period along the orthorhombic A direction, B direction. And if you write out the structure factor and match up the intensities, you get something like 2/1000 of an angstrom distortion. Another scenario is that the oxygen octahedra are modulated. And actually, it's something interesting. In the high TCs, the octahedra are somewhat psychotic. In fact, when you go from the LTO phase up to the HTT phase, the orthorhombic tilts don't actually completely vanish. They actually, for a short time, become incommensurate and diffuse and have their own dispersion with temperature, which is very... So there's something weird going on with the out-of-plane motions of the oxygens. And interestingly, that's the same one implicated to be the mode that gives you the kink in ARPES. Anyway, so if you evaluate a scenario of out-of-plane oxygen motions, modulated at the wave vector, you get around also 2/1000ths of an angstrom amplitude. And the only one that came out to be reasonably large was an in-plane motion of coppers, which might look like that. And that came out to around 1/14000ths of an angstrom. Anyway, they're all very small compared to blue bronze, which is 0.05. Okay, so the lattice one thing I didn't mention, if you just measure the 002 Bragg peak, that's just the one from the layers being stacked on top of one another, its intensity is quite, feels the stripe. So when they set in, this thing grows in intensity. So the lattice is doing something, modulating the distances between layers or something like that. So it's definitely involved in some integral way, but how is not entirely clear. All right, so I want to return to my artifacts, and then we'll, then we can argue about all kinds of stuff. All right. So could it be specular reflectivity from the surface? The answer is no, because it is sharp in L. That is in K perpendicular. If you scan K perp, you get a peak. You don't get a broad thing. That can't. The signature of reflectivity is something that is broad along L because a truncation of the surface means translational symmetry is broken along that direction, which means L is not a good quantum number anymore. It's sharp in that direction, so this is absolutely not it. Is it a 002 reflection from another grain? The answer to that is also no, and that's because the experimental signature of another grain would be the L value is not exactly at 2, it's a little bit less than 2. And if you do very careful measurement of the 002 and the wave vector of the charge order, they sit smack on right at 2. Okay? So in other words, the total wave vector of the modulation is a little bit higher, just high enough to account for the fact that they stack in the way that they do. So it's definitely not another grain. And in particular, we also see the sibling reflection in the other direction, and we also see the twin reflection. So it can't just be some accidental grain pointing in another way. Plus, we saw it in another sample, and that would unlikely have the same. And also, its energy dependence, if you put the energy dependence of the 002 and the energy dependence of the peak, they look completely different. So that would also, so we can resoundingly discount this. Could it be some incidental other lattice distortion, like ordering of the zinc atoms, or even the strontium atoms? Or could it be that adding zinc causes strain, which creates some kind of buckling? The answer is no, because it has the wrong energy dependence. That would look like the 002. It has too much temperature dependence. Actually, if you look at the supermodulation in BISCO, it is slightly temperature dependent, but not overwhelmingly so, because strain is always there. You can't completely get rid of it just with thermal expansion. This thing completely goes away, or almost goes away. And the off-resonant part is really too weak. In a supermodulation, if it's due to some structural ordering, you see it at all energies, and when you go through an edge, you just see some anomaly. And we don't see anything like that at all. The off-resonant part is way too weak. So we can more or less get rid of that. So at that point, after having done this for, I don't want to count how many years, 8 years now, I guess, I can't think of anything else it is besides a charge density wave. So I'm pretty sure it's real. So in conclusion, charge order exists in LSCO2. And it's not there, it may be there at very low temperature, but it's there all the time if you put in an uncharged random potential to pin the fluctuation. They are unidirectional, just like the spin order, and along the same direction. And importantly, the ratio of the wave vectors is roughly 1/2, but not exactly. But that seems to agree with the general rho s squared that you might expect when you construct some free energy invariant. And the point is that this number deviates from the ideal value, and it also shifts with temperature. And that actually looks a whole lot like chromium or blue bronze, which suggests that there's some kind of lattice involvement that makes that shifts this thing slightly from its ideal value, because it needs to accommodate the lattice in some way. The charge or the spin order sits in at 20K, but the charge order is visible at much higher temperatures, though some of that, to some extent, is just because the intensity is so high. And so when it's really high, you can obviously see characteristics of the transition to high temperature. So I guess we need to analyze the actual shape of the temperature dependence. They stack in a manner that's unfavorable for Coulomb, and that these two things together, plus the temperature dependence of that Bragg peak, suggest that the lattice is involved in this thing in some way, though not a huge to a huge degree. And so why does it live to such high temperature? It's sort of a perfect combination of factors. I mean, the LTO crystal structure has diagonal tilts. At the same time, at dilute doping, the stripes or whatever they are tend to want to be diagonal too. So they sort of cooperate. Then you add zinc, which tends to pin magnetic fluctuations. And then you add the fact that if they're diagonal, unlike horizontal in LBCO or lanthanum, neodymium, strontium, copper oxide, there's no necessity to stagger them anymore because that's only necessary because of the body-centered tetragonal symmetry of the unit cell. If you make them diagonal, you don't have to stagger them like that anymore, and then they tend to fit. So it's sort of just all the right factors to make it stable. Anyway, but the energy scale that drives them is high, whatever it is. So that's the end. Thanks a lot.
Well, I think there will be many questions, comments. Well, there are already many.
Already.
So is this consistent? This does not seem consistent with the standard sort of Yan-Zanon type stripes.
No. Well, that's a key point. So the standard Yan-Zanon type stripes was really just holes moving in a frustrated spin background. And there, in that scenario, they ought to order at the same temperature because the only reason the spins order, charges order, is because of the spin. There's this other school, the Vic Emery, Steve Kivelson school, that address things more from the Coulomb frustrated phase separation point of view. And in that point of view, the charges should order higher because when you put in long-range Coulomb, they have a tendency to order on their own, and then the spins follow later. So that was favored. I believe that's how Kivelson and Tronquata ended up talking a lot, was because they saw this, the spins in lanthanum in this other material order at a higher temperature than the charge. So this is sort of an extreme example of that.
And there is a short school, I would say, which is later view.
Yeah.
Like charge estimations effectively something.
The lattices.
Mostly driven by the train, by
later
view.
Yeah.
The train may be okay.
Well, but it's a different category than, I mean, blue bronze has a lattice distortion of 0.05 angstrom, so it's a factor of 50 bigger. You don't even need a synchrotron to study blue bronze.
I argue that it's not really Coulomb-driven because of rock static. In that sense, it's actually...
Because of why?
Rock static.
Yeah. So on the other hand, the period, there's an important...
The way, it's very common thing also in manganese. Also, all these charge density wave or charge ordering or whatever stripes, you can argue that it's a kind of checkerboard in plane, but they are always on top of another in phase and not out of phase.
Right, though those systems.
Again, argument that it's not really cool.
Those systems have big lattice distortions too.
Right.
But, and also, another thing to remember, this thing has a very large period. In LBCO, the period is 4A. This is 12 diagonal lattice parameters. So it's got a huge period. So the amount of charge per unit area, meaning delta N, not A, is very small. So I think the Coulomb is pretty diluted by the fact that the wavelength is large.
But if you, the picture you're getting at, I guess, is that there is this charge density wave also in the system without zinc, but only it's fluctuating and you're thinning it by putting in zinc.
Yeah.
But then I don't understand why there should be this huge correlation length in the C direction.
I don't know. I mean, it could be that that's the way it wanted to be in LBCO too, but it couldn't because it has to stagger from layer to layer. You know, when they're horizontal, you can't stagger them. You can't make the next layer horizontal and have them fit halfway in between one another because there's this glide plane symmetry of one layer to the next. But when you make them diagonal, suddenly you can do anything you want. you have to sit down and draw a picture, and I should have done it. But so it could be that this is the normal scenario, and LBCO is the sort of a frustrated scenario.
If there is charge density wave or dynamical charge density waves in fluctuating around in LSCO, wouldn't you pick them up and then diffuse?
I have tried that, but it's just too diffuse. I mean, when something becomes diffuse, it becomes low in intensity and broad, and then it's very hard to distinguish it from other sources of background. So that was...
Somehow the very logic is still strange for me. If you assume that, for instance, there are some incipient charge density wave already without zinc, but it's pinned by zinc, but zinc is random. So
yeah.
I would expect the other way around. That,
yes.
In
your right.
system, it would be well developed.
Yeah.
And seen, and random purity would wash it out.
It doesn't make sense completely.
So
well, but it is known that if you have a
also
system.
Also, naturally, about the standard charge density wave, like niobium, selenium 2 or whatever, if you dope the system, what becomes of that? Do they become stronger or become weaker?
One thing that happens is, so niobium triselenide above the phase transition has giant Friedel oscillations if you put in impurities. So okay, let me answer your question with a picture. All right, so here's, if you do niobium Se3 and you plot temperature here, the order parameter has a nice mean field temperature dependence with square root of 2. You put in impurities, whatever you want, it does this. Okay, so it reduces the order parameter down here, but up here, it actually enhances it because you get around each impurity a pinned CDW fluctuation. And there are giant Friedel oscillations because but they're enormous because there's a CDW that's incipient. So something like this is
what
worked here.
For instance, these features in spectra, are these peak broad and so on?
They broaden, yeah. So if you go down here.
That's what I would expect. You have an enormous sharpening when you increase zinc. And I would expect broadening from the sharpening.
Yeah, it's weird. I don't know. That depends on the temperature. If you're up here, they sharpen.
It depends on what mechanism you to melt the charge density wave. Right.
Say that again.
It depends on which mechanism you cook up to get rid of it or to make the charge density wave dynamical.
You mean with temperature? Oh, down here. Yeah. Well, yeah, so I guess the tendency is there are some quantum fluctuations present at low temperature, and you're sort of in this situation, and then you put in some impurities, and then it becomes more static. I agree with you, it's very strange. You add impurities and something becomes sharper.
There was an old story, actually, at the very beginning of this high density story. People looked at what zinc is doing and looking at ESR.
Yeah.
Then it was there was actually no problem that without doping you don't see PSR and why that was not really clear. But then when you include non-magnetic impurities, you suddenly see very clear PSR signal, very clear locomotion.
Yeah.
And the standard picture was or not standard picture, but one of the explanations was that you have something like RDB, like singlet tendency formation, singlet. Without zinc, but zinc is simply just removes one of the pairs of this spin signal, and then the remaining spin you see in here.
Yeah, actually it
so
does.
I don't know, maybe
it does that too.
Like this,
but that's one established.
Did you want to say something?
Yeah, what's the line shape like?
Momentum?
Is it a dimension or does it have two components?
Actually, that's a good question. We haven't really fit it. That's it. Yeah. I guess it looks Gaussian to me. It has pretty sharp.
So when you have systems with long range order but with disorder kind of in the picture, you tend to have two components, a dimension and a square dimension, right?
Yeah. Actually, we don't know because this is very close to our resolution limit and this is basically our resolution broadening. I think these numbers are lower bounds. We don't have the resolution to really measure it. That's something we're going to do.
Do you see any change below the magnetic temperature?
We actually didn't even go down that far. We had a different cryostat in that is actually for doing azimuthal scans. You might know about that. And we ended up doing this, and that only goes down to 42K, which is where we did the whole thing. So that's going to happen in February next year. Yeah.
What are the bulk properties actually? What's the resistivity of this thing? And
the resistivity, the normal state resistivity is higher if you add zinc, but I don't remember how much.
How much higher?
I don't remember.
Is it possible that it's simply much better insulated?
Why would that help?
I don't know why it would help, but somehow it
may help. All I know is it's not super. I don't remember the normal state resistivity. I don't remember.
Yeah,
I was going to show something else.
Oh, yeah. Like bulk properties, how do they change when you just add the zinc?
I got to show you something else that's completely weird before everybody leaves. This is an H scan at 10K. If you go below the magnetic ordering temperature, this is neutrons now. This was done in Sendai. You're from Sendai, right? What?
Magnetic?
This is the charge scattering measured with neutrons.
Charging?
Yes. So they went back and looked at the samples themselves with there's a reactor there, and they checked, and they see the peak. So actually, the whole thing, it's very weak. It's in the same position. If you cool the 10K, you see another superstructure form at a different wave vector. So it actually, there's another order parameter that shows up below 20K. And that has it looks like it's at about half the wave vector of this. Like this is actually some harmonic of that. So there's some non-sinusoidal thing that happens at very low temperature. So this is where we're going next, is to look at this stuff. This is our peak that we saw, and this is a harmonic at lower wave vector. In fact, you know, it's not exactly a factor of two, it's just a... So there's yet another order parameter that shows up.
But it may be harmonic.
This would have to be a harmonic of that, because it's actually a lower wave vector. So it has a longer wave vector. harmonic should be a higher integer multiples of the peak, and this is at a lower multiple.
Subharmonic.
Yeah.
Parametric mixing.
There's a new periodicity that enters. I don't know. It gets weirder every day. At first, I didn't even want to talk about it, but I think it's real. So I welcome.
Can you say a word about what's the advantage of this elastic scattering method over the inelastic one?
Inelastic is always better if you can do it. I mean, the only difference between elastic and inelastic, technically, this is energy integrated. It's not elastic. So if you have energy resolving, that's always gives you more information than, but it's a matter of how to do it experimentally.
You lose intensity,
also just how to do it. We haven't figured out how to do it. You need a monochromator for X-rays that are diffusely scattered that has high resolution, and that's technology that does not exist. I think there are ways to do it, but okay, so I welcome ideas for what to say about all this stuff. So.
So Peter, how long are you here still?